Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th Canto, Chapter 13, The Behavior of a Perfect Person, Text 31.
Ajatmika jibhir
dukkhar
Avimuktasya kahichit Martyasya kritrap Martyasya kritropanatar Artai kamai creator kim Ajatmika dibhijukka Avimuktasya kahichit Martyasya kritrapanatar Artai kamai creator kim Ajatmika dibhijukka Avimuktasya karhichit Martyasya kritropanatar Artai kamai creator kim Ajatmika adibi Adhyatmika, Adhidaivika, and Adhibhautika. Dukkai, by the threefold miseries of material life. Avimuktasya, of one who is not freed from such miserable conditions. Or one who is subjected to birth, death, old age, and disease. Karhichit, sometimes, Martyasya, of the living entity subjected to death. Kritra upanatai, things obtained because of severe miseries. Arthai, even if some benefit is derived. Kamai, which can fulfill one's material desires. Kriyata, what do they do? Kim, and what is the value of such happiness? Translation. The python man continues to speak to Prahlad Maharaj. Materialistic activities are always mixed with three kinds of miserable conditions, ajatmika, adidaivika, and ajibhautika. Therefore, even if one achieves some success by performing such activities, what is the benefit of this success? One is still subjected to birth, death, old age, disease, and the reactions of his fruitive activities. Purport. According to the materialistic way of life, if a poor man, after laboring very, very hard, gets some material profit at the end of his life, he is considered a success, even though he again dies while suffering the threefold miseries, adiatmika, adidaivika, and adibhautika. No one can escape the threefold miseries of materialistic life, namely, miseries pertaining to the body and mind, miseries pertaining to the difficulties imposed by society, community, nation, and other living entities, and miseries inflicted upon us by natural disturbances from earthquakes, famines, droughts, floods, epidemics, and so on. If one works very hard, suffering the threefold miseries, and then is successful in getting some small benefit, what is the value of this benefit? Besides that, even if a Garmi is successful in accumulating some material wealth, he still cannot enjoy it, for he must die in bereavement. I have seen a dying man begging a medical attendant to increase his life by 4 years so he could complete his material plans. Of course, the medical man was unsuccessful in expanding the life of the man, who therefore died in great bereavement. Everyone must die in this way, and after one's mental condition is taken into account by the laws of material nature, he is given another chance to fulfill his desires in a different body. Material plans for material happiness have no value, but under the spell of the illusory energy, we consider them extremely valuable. There were many politicians, social reformers, and philosophers who died very miserably without deriving any practical value from their material plans. Therefore, a sane and sensible man never desires to work hard under the conditions of threefold miseries, only to die in disappointment. Om Agyana Trimadandasya Gyananjana Salakaya Chakshu Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasati Gaur Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Yesterday's purport promised us that we would become informed in today's verse by how the conditioned soul suffers in the cycle of happiness and distress. Yesterday we discussed the samsara chakra, the wheel of material existence. And we heard, as the wheel goes up and down, similarly, the living entity is sometimes happy and sometimes distressed. Those of you who have read Chaitanya Charitamrita know about the example of the medieval dunking stool. Generally, in schools, when they teach you about medieval times, don't they always have pictures of the dunking stool? They do that?
Yes.
It's kind of like a classic, you know. That, you know, this was horrible, and such things are never done again. You know, someone did some offense, which wasn't so bad to warrant being put in jail, but in the eyes of society, some chastisement was warranted. So, who here doesn't know what a dunking stool is? It's a chair on a long pole by the side of the river. And so they put the offender in the chair, strap him in, her in, and then they dunk you under the river until you practically are drowning. Then they suddenly bring you up again into the air. And just when you start to feel good relief, they plunge you down in the water again so you're almost drowned. And then bring you up again. It's very psychologically scary. It sounds like, well, what's the big deal? You know you'll be coming up again. No, when you're under the water, you know, and your lungs are can't take it anymore, it's just really intense experience. And then you're yanked up into the air, relief. And before you can really enjoy the relief, plunge down into the water again. So, this is how Chaitanya Charitamrita describes the samsara chakra, the wheel of material existence. Sometimes you're up high in the heavenly planets, and sometimes you're plunged low into the lower planetary systems. And it all depends on your karmic activities. But whether you have good karma, which is so rare these days, or bad karma, you're forced to go up and down. The whole thing is driven by time. We spoke yesterday about how time is also a wheel, Kala Chakra. You've got to become educated to see all these wheels in action. They're interrelated. These are allegorical devices to help you understand the wheel of material existence, the wheel of time. And yesterday we asked that you feel how the wheel of time is crushing you, just like Prahlad Maharaj said in his prayer. Crushed by the wheel of time with its 16 spokes. What are the 16 spokes? Who remembers? Yes. Five gross elements, the five knowledge-acquiring senses, the five working senses, and the leader of the senses, the mind. These are, what Prahlad Maharaj says, are the spokes of the wheel of time that's crushing the conditioned soul. Sometimes that wheel of time, Kala Chakra, is described as crushing and cracking you into different shapes, into different bodies. And you take it all to be an affair that may lead to some happiness, and therefore the suffering is worth it. You'll find some places on this earth where everyone can easily see life is so much suffering. Just like, imagine if you were living in North Korea now, where the people are so hungry from lack of food that they go into the mountains and scavenge for ferns and acorns to bring them back to their village to eat. Meanwhile, their government is trying to build nuclear weapons. This is the age of culling. Of course, you would say, well, in real humane societies, such things would never happen. But in so-called humane just societies, huge proportions of the government's money is spent on military buildup. Of course, I know not in New Zealand. But everyone knows what will happen if New Zealand is ever in some kind of international difficulty. They'll immediately call for help. Yes, bring those nuclear weapons. The tune will change very quickly in time of distress. And as you all know, even though World War II never touched New Zealand, all the men were shipped out to the war to get the karma. This is the way the laws of nature work. Okay. It's not in the cards, so to speak. It's not in destiny that the war directly touches New Zealand, but indirectly, everyone will get it, because all the men will be shipped overseas to die, and all the ladies will be left forlorn. So, in some places, it is easier to see that there is suffering. In places like New Zealand, you have the hope that although there's some suffering, there's going to be enough happiness and contentment to make it all worth it. Right? It's not going to be that bad. There'll be some suffering. There'll be some, I think here, unless someone is very physically sick, suffering is considered to be boredom. Not having anything exciting to do, that's considered suffering here. Well, people consider, there'll be some very boring moments. There can be physical disease, but there'll be enough happiness to make it worthwhile. In other words, you'll get a few gasps of air before you're plunged under the water in the dunking stool. And those few gasps of air are mainly just relief, the feeling of relief, not the feeling of happiness. It's just, I'm not suffering anymore. That's not true happiness. True happiness has no relation to suffering. Ananda, or spiritual bliss, derived from the relationship between the soul and the supreme soul, has nothing to do with material distress. Therefore, you're very foolish to think that in order to really appreciate happiness, you have to suffer a bit. Because true happiness has nothing to do with suffering. True happiness is just not the opposite pole of the dualities of material existence. Happiness, distress, pain, pleasure. True happiness is above the dualities of material existence. People have a hard time understanding that when they first approach Krishna consciousness, because they're coming, for the most part, for relief. And they think that the spiritual experience will give them relief and it'll give them happiness as defined in relation to distress. But once you start to chant Hare Krishna, you begin to realize there's a level of happiness that has nothing to do with distress. In fact, it has nothing to do with material happiness. That is transcendental happiness. That is ananda. The kind of happiness that has nothing to do with material happiness or distress. But you can't know that at first. Actually, you're tasting it as soon as you come to Krishna consciousness. You're tasting that transcendental ananda, that bliss. But you can't really understand it in context until you educate yourself. That's why studying the books is so important, so that you can understand what's happening to you. First of all, so you can understand the process of material existence. And secondly, so you can understand the qualitative distinctness of the happiness you're experiencing in Krishna consciousness. It has nothing to do with sukha or dukkha, material happiness or material distress. Gradually you begin to discriminate between spiritual happiness and spiritual emotions and material happiness and distress and material emotions. Just like with a coconut, when the coconut starts to dry, of course you're not also familiar with coconuts, are you? In tropical countries, people aren't familiar with coconuts. When you go to India, you'll become more knowledgeable of coconuts. You just get the milk from coconuts already processed, is that it? Yes. See the glories of advanced civilization. You don't have to crack the coconut. It's already bottled for you. Comes the bottle or what? Can coconut juice. But if you know about coconuts, you understand that as the coconut ripens, the inside separates from the hull, the outer shell. And you can clearly distinguish between the outer shell, the hull, or the husk, and the inside. Similarly, as you mature in Krishna consciousness, you're able to discriminate between material emotions and spiritual emotions. But in the beginning, it's all jumbled up. And you just think, wow, I feel relief. I'm not suffering anymore. I'm tasting something. I'm happy. You don't know so much about the qualitative composition of that happiness you're tasting. But as you become more advanced, as you become more knowledgeable, you begin to realize, I'm involved with something that has nothing to do with material happiness and distress. I'm involved with an experience that is beyond the reach of the laws of material nature. And then, upon obtaining that realization, you're very eager to safeguard your status by carefully following the regular principles, because you don't want to jeopardize your claim to the spiritual platform. You don't want to slide back into material happiness and distress. So please remember that example from Chaitanya Charitamrita about the dunking stool. Is it true happiness when you're hoisted out of the water into the air? Is that really happiness? No, it's just relief from material distress. And how temporary is that relief? You're going right back into the water again. So the result of the dunking stool being put into the river and brought up again, again and again, it's just an excruciating experience that you never forget. And as I told you, it's not that you get solace while you're under the water that I'll be brought up soon. No, they keep you under there so long that you just panic completely. You lose it. It's acute suffering. You don't know what's going to happen. When the mind becomes overwhelmed with terror, you start thinking, maybe they're going to keep me under here after all. Maybe they don't understand that I'm almost at the breaking point. You have to understand the capacity of the mind to torture you in so many ways. As the Bhagavatam explains, material existence comes to you through the mind. And the suffering of material existence is there in the mind. Just like sometimes people think, okay, I'm going to die. Let it happen. Get it over with. They don't see the mental terror that they're going to go through. And no doctors can pick up on that. Therefore, they have these naive statements that someone died peacefully in the sleep. There's no such thing. It's just that they cannot detect the terror that the mind is going through. Now, let us consider the composition of the alluring beverage of material existence. As you read here, adhyatmika jibhir dukkhar. Materialistic activities are always mixed with three kinds of miserable conditions. So when you're going to the pub of material existence and getting your drink, you've got to know what's in the drink. It looks very nice. In those pictures we saw that Tara took, you could see some of the drinks that they were mixing at the parties. It looked very nice, like red, reddish, pinkish. My father, he was known amongst my relatives as being very expert at mixing drinks. I might have told you once, I think I was around 14 years old, and we were at some family gathering. Relatives on my father's side, because my mother's, on my mother's side, they were all very pious and strict Christians, you know, and drinking. On my father's side, they were, they were into the suave, sophisticated, flash life. So he and some of his kin, they were, you know, they had gathered together, and then they had him mix some drinks. And then, you know, he had all the shakers and this and that, and all the paraphernalia. And then he poured the drinks into everyone's cup from the this kind of mixing canister. You, I don't know. And they pour, and they all, and then they looked at, one of them looked at me, one of the his relatives looked at me and said, one day you'll be able to mix drinks like your father. Bestowing his blessings upon me. Complimenting my father, because my father was there, you know, and also letting me know that I could share in the, you know, the legacy. One day you'll be able to mix drinks like your father. So, let's look at what's in the mixed drink, in the cocktail of material existence. You have to take a good look. Don't just become fascinated by the color, by the smell, by things are bubbling. Maybe a cherry in it. Yes, they put a cherry in it sometimes, or a slice of what? Slice of lemon. So you become really fascinated by that. It looks attractive. Maybe it smells attractive. I don't know. But what's actually in there? Threefold miseries. Adhyatmika, adhidaivika, adhibhautika. Miseries pertaining to your own body and mind. Miseries brought about by other living entities. individual and banded together in a society. Miseries come to you in that way. And then miseries brought about by natural disasters. Earthquakes. Flu. Just like a few months ago you had such a severe flu come through New Zealand. Knocked you out for 3 days. In the early days of Krishna consciousness in the West, as soon as you were a new person coming, you immediately learned about the threefold miseries. Every new practitioner of Krishna consciousness could recite Adiyatmika, Adidaivika, Adibhojika. Because we didn't have that many books back then. So the Isra Upanishad was a main book. It was Bhagavad Gita. So whatever was in those few books, everyone learned. So every newcomer could recite to any guest the threefold miseries, Adiyatmika, Adidaivika, Adibhojika. It's true. That's what's there in the cocktail of material existence. Although it looks so alluring, you have to actually see what's inside the drink. So, when you are about to perform material activities, you should understand what you're drinking. You're drinking these kinds of miseries. So why should you be surprised when indeed these miseries become manifest? But out of ignorance, everyone is always shocked. How could this happen? Oh my God, I didn't plan for this. Why? A lack of knowledge is a very dangerous thing. It means that without the knowledge of Srimad Bhagavatam, you'll be left sleeping in the darkness of ignorance. And you'll call that advancement? The more you educate yourself in Srimad Bhagavatam, the more you understand how foolish and ignorant people are. You see, you can make the mistake of becoming impressed by the superficial expertise people display in passionate activities. Superficial expertise. You can really become impressed by that. You don't see through the whole thing. Just like you become fascinated by the external appearance of a cocktail, the color, the lemon slice in it. You don't understand what the cocktail actually does, how it dulls your brain. You're just fascinated by the external appearance. But Bhagavatam is teaching you, don't become bewildered by the superficial expertise that materialists display in their passionate affairs. See through the core. See what's going on. Now, this verse is telling you that number one, materialistic activities are always mixed with three kinds of miserable conditions that you should watch for when you're walking in the city, going here and there. Try to understand these things. Remember these instructions of the Python Man. You're going to work, or you're in Montreal. Think about these things. All the activities I'm seeing are mixed with these three miseries. You may think you see people enjoying, but if you look deeper past the lemon slice and the cocktail, you'll see the threefold miseries at work. Furthermore, this verse says, therefore, even if one achieves some success by performing such activities, what is the benefit of this success? In other words, you can't win. Even if you think, okay, I'm suffering, but I'm going to get success. What's the real benefit of that success? I don't know if any of you have tried to achieve something in the material world which involved some austerity, going through some struggle, voluntarily taking upon yourself some inconveniences. Maybe schoolwork or a job, something. You wanted to get something So you voluntarily put yourself through an ordeal. Any of you ever done that? For what? Hey, huh? To be an architect, huh? You're going to design buildings that would be world famous, right? So you voluntarily accept inconvenience to get that goal. You want the top grades. Anyone else? None of you ever? Yes? Your hope is that by enslaving by designing these rugby league computer games that you'll advance to the ranks, right? You'll become a top dog in the programming field. Anyone else? Yeah? These are German club austerities. After a wild night, you have to go home and it's freezing outside. Wait, in Hamburg? Ooh, it's definitely cold in the winter in Hamburg. And you have to walk home. Wait for the bus. Alone? Sometimes. I like this So how is that an example of going through so much suffering to get something desired? What's the goal? To enjoy at the club? Yes. The Python Man is trying to teach you to analyze properly, not to be such a fool living in this world. So he's saying, even if you think there's success, what's the benefit of it? We were speaking last night about former Prime Minister, how he was presenting at his peak achievement, his greatest glory, that even after my fall from political power, the government later turned to me and asked me to be ambassador, high commissioner to India. Oh, he said, oh, that was the ultimate. But he couldn't do it. His wife wouldn't let him. His second wife wouldn't let him. But still, just to be asked, that success of being asked, that was a high point in his career. You're all thinking, so what? You couldn't go. You don't understand how material nature works. There's something that pushes you to give yourself credit for something. You want to be proud of something. I was asked to be high commissioner, even though my wife wouldn't let me do what I was asked. Material nature confers a false sense of honor upon you, which you're so ready to accept. Now, what are we to do about all this? This is very powerful information. It's meant to motivate us to change our lifestyle. And for those who have already changed their lifestyle, this information is meant to vaccinate you, to keep you from going back. And even better, to equip you for reaching out for helping others. That's what this information is meant for. You can never hear it enough because material nature is so powerful, so bewildering. We should be careful not to have a naive, carefree attitude about material existence, we need to understand the nature of the bewildering material energy. We've been speaking about how becoming Krishna conscious means changing the energy that you're living under, changing from the influence of the material energy to the influence of the spiritual energy. Both the material and spiritual energy belong to Krishna, but the material energy acts in such a way as to bewilder conditioned souls. The energy of Krishna is actually one. As the Vishnu Purana states, Vishnu Shakti Pada Prupta Chaitra Yakya Tata Pada. The Vishnu Shakti, the energy of the Lord, is one, but it acts in different ways. So the material energy is ultimately spiritual, because Krishna is all spiritual. But that energy is acting in a way to cause bewilderment. The easy example is the sun. The sun illuminates, but the sun, by shining on the ocean, evaporates ocean water, and that evaporated water becomes clouds, and the clouds block the sun. So ultimately, the clouds are the creation of the sun, but the purpose of the clouds is to block the sun. Similarly, the material energy is the creation of Krishna, but its purpose is to block Krishna from your view. So you don't see the sun, you don't see the illumination. In this way, you can understand how both the potency of nescience or darkness and the potency of illumination are both coming from Krishna. There's nothing that doesn't come from Krishna. But even though the material energy comes from Krishna, we're not meant to live under the influence of the material energy. In the overall situation of the cosmic manifestation, it is a crime to drive under the influence of the material energy. What do you call it here? Driving in DUI? Oh, you have another? Drink driving. In some countries they call it DUI. They just, I'll say drink driving, they just abbreviate it DUI. Driving under the influence, DUI. Where was I? I was going somewhere. I was in Russia, I think. And we were on our way to the airport trying to make the flight in St. Petersburg. And then the Russian police, they had a big roadblock and they were pulling over people, testing them for drink driving. You know, they give you something you blow into. Make sure you're not over the limit. So, material life means everyone is driving under the influence of material illusion. That is a crime. The whole point of Krishna's instructions in Bhagavad Gita, the whole point of Srimad Bhagavatam, is to teach you how even within the material world, you can drive under the influence of the spiritual energy. Just because you're in the material world is no excuse. There is ample knowledge, ample expertise for you to live under the influence of the spiritual energy. Therefore, what does Krishna say? Mahatmanas tumam partha daivim prakritam ashrita. The Mahatma, the great soul, is under the influence of the internal potency. Bhajantyananyamanaso. Therefore, under the influence of that spiritual energy, he performs devotional service without cessation. Gyatra bhutanam avyayam. Understanding that Krishna is the inexhaustible source of everything. This step you have to make in your life, this pivotal step of changing the influence that you're living under, just like we were talking yesterday about. Someone was telling me how she had an intense 2-month affair, the coming together of two embodied spirits, as the New Agers say. Coming together in an explosion of Rajagun, motor passion. And at first the passion is so absorbing, but then, somehow or other, mysteriously, things go wrong. What happened? She was telling me that somehow or other, he started finding faults in her, and she started finding faults in him. How did all this happen? How did, from pure, delightful passion, so delightful, at least she was thinking, this could be it. This could be the real thing. And 2 months later, I think I've had enough of you. And, you know, the way you politely say I've had enough of you is, I think we need a break from each other for a while, just to step back and look at this affair, you know, more clearly. You know, that's a polite way of saying, I think we've had enough of each other. But what amazed me in her description, that's why I like to hear these live accounts, is how did it happen? How did the happiness transform into something else? One minute there was the pure, passionate connections. The next minute there was argument. The answer is given in this verse. What's in that beverage of materialistic activities? You've got to look closer. Packaged in to the beverage, mixed in, an essential part of the beverage are the threefold miseries. It's there. You just don't see it. Because the nature of Maya is to put you to sleep. So you can't really understand what's going on. You're sleeping on the lap of ignorance. So therefore you scratch your head. What happened? Pure material happiness, and then it turned into distress. What's going on? There's no such thing as pure material happiness. The whole beverage has distress mixed in. It's not that it's laced with distress. Distress is an essential ingredient. When you realize that, then you can understand. Then she was telling me, maybe I made a mistake. I happened to mention that, you know, you're the first person I ever met that I considered marrying. From that moment, the guy, whoa, wait a minute now. Put the car into reverse, you know. Yeah, having a casual girlfriend who you can plunder at will, you know, that's very nice, but commitment? No way. So, you know, interesting sociological perspective. As soon as she mentioned anything that resembled commitment, but you're the first person I met who I ever considered marrying, the guy freaked out. Bhumna Krishna was telling me about one of his relatives or someone he knew. She was in her early 40s and, you know, wasn't married, you know, usual train of partners. And so she was at a party, you know, of adults, and, you know, they were drinking and she was drinking, and so, you know, she started acting in an obliging way with one man there. And the man got all, like, you know, excited with anticipation. And, you know, she brought him back to her house. And, you know, the guy was like, you know, wow. They didn't know each other before. But anyway, you know, when there's intoxication, you know, everything can happen. So the man was very eager. And, you know, she brought him back to her house at, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning. You know, it looked like, you know, all systems were go. And then all of a sudden, she just, you know, she was sitting at the kitchen table with him, and she just started pouring out her heart. Oh, you know, I want so badly to have children. Oh, you know, I really, really want to have a family. And the guy just looked at her, you know, and just, you know, just walked in and ran out the door like, wait, the script isn't going the right way, you know? I mean, this lady's crazy. I thought we were going to have a, you know, a happy one-night affair, and she's just pouring out her heart. I really want children. I'm 40 years old. I have to have children somehow. And he's like, oh my God, let's get the hell out of here. I love hearing these stories because it's the truth. This is the thing you don't hear about on television and in the newspapers, the truth of material existence. This is the reward from preaching Krishna consciousness, you get to deal with reality. So I relish these stories very much, as you know. And I'm always on the lookout for newer and newer stories. You know? Yeah. Because they teach you what's for real. Most people don't want to deal with reality, but devotees are very eager. Practitioners of Krishna consciousness are very eager to see reality and deal with it. We want to see the energies at work, the energy of illusion, the energy of enlightenment. We want to change our situation. We want to change the energy we're located under. And then your life changes. Krishna consciousness means acting according to techniques that will change the energy that you're operating under. Otherwise, as long as you're in the grip of material nature, you must suffer. You must be disappointed. You must be bewildered and illusion. Just get out from that energy, everything changes. When Krishna appeared in Mathura, you can see the various energies at work and how different kinds of persons responded to those energies. As you know, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Sambhavami Apamaya, in the fourth chapter, I appear in the material world my own way. I'm not forced to appear by the material energy. I have my own internal potency, mechanism for appearing in this world. I appear through pure spiritual techniques. I'm not forced by the material laws of nature to take birth. I come through a spiritual conduit, so to speak. Sambhavami, atmamaya, my own personal energy, not the external shadow energy of illusion. My own personal spiritual energy, that's how I come to this world. When Krishna comes to this world, he has his internal spiritual potencies arranging everything. That's the job of yoga maya. Just like by the arrangement of yoga maya, Krishna changed from four-handed form to a two-handed form. In any case, he's Swayam Bhagavan, the original personality of Godhead. But because of the emotional state of Devaki, he changed. He came in four hands. She was so afraid of Kamsa. She was so afraid of her terrifying situation that just to make sure she understood that the Supreme Lord had appeared as her son, Krishna came as four hands, although he is the original personality of Godhead. So that taking on of four hands was just in response to Devaki's emotions. And then when Devaki told him, actually, you know, I understand you're the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but it's going to be very difficult to hide a baby with four hands. And so, would you please kindly change yourself into your two-handed form? So then Krishna did that. Of course, it's paradoxical, contradictory. If she understands Krishna's Supreme Lord, then why should she fear for him? But Devaki, she's mixed in terms of awe and reverence and spontaneous attraction for Krishna. Whereas Yashoda in Vrindavan is pure spontaneous attraction for Krishna, never thinking that Krishna is the Supreme Lord, simply thinking he's my all-attractive son. So Yogamaya arranged that. The spiritual potencies of the Lord arranged that Krishna would change into his two-handed form. Now, Vasudeva was impelled by Yoga Maya, the spiritual potency, to carry Krishna from Mathura to Vrindavan. In order for him to do that, all the guards in the prison had to fall asleep. So that was done not directly by Yoga Maya, that's done by the department of Yoga Maya known as Mahamaya, which deals with conditioned souls, bewilders conditioned souls. Ultimately, at the root, everything is Yoga Maya. That's why in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Yoga Maya Samavrata. I'm not manifest to everyone, Naham Prakasha Sarvasya. I cover myself from them by my potency of Yoga Maya. It's not actually Yoga Maya that directly deals with the conditioned souls. It is Mahamaya. But Mahamaya is a department of Yoga Maya. So in a general way, you can say Yoga Maya. But if you want to be more precise, you say Mahamaya. So Mahamaya caused all the guards in the prison house to go to sleep. Their ganendriyas, their knowledge-acquiring senses, were completely dulled and put to sleep by the Mahamaya potency. And then Vasudeva was able to carry the child out of the prison across the Jamuna River to Gokul. Then, when he was returning with Yashoda Mai's daughter, which was going to take the place of Krishna, Yoga Maya arranged everything for him. He got back into the prison, shackled himself, and then the guards woke up, hearing the crying of the newborn child. They went and informed Kamsa. Immediately Kamsa, he was up all night in anxiety. He rose up in desperation. Kala ayam, time is here. He understood. Time had taken its birth. And you actually can't defeat time. But still he was determined to save himself. So he came into the prison room where Devaki had the baby girl. The baby girl is actually Yashoda Mai's child. And the exchange had sent Krishna to Vrindavan with Yashoda Mai, and Yashoda Mai's daughter was brought back by Vasudeva in Krishna's place. So Kamsa immediately wanted to take action to kill the baby daughter. Now, this is the nature of demoniac life, and please don't be fooled by it, no matter how nice it is packaged, no matter how mannerly and courteous it is packaged. Demoniac life means, whenever it comes to my sense gratification, I do whatever is necessary to preserve it. That's demoniac. The first principle is me and my pleasure. And then you just got to do what you got to do. I'm sure you've had friends who you've told that to, or they've told it to you. They've told it to you. You know, you just got to do what you got to do to get over and get by. It's the way it is. And everyone nods their head. Yep, yep, that's the bottom line. That's the principle. Do what you got to do to get over and get by. I remember in the early 70s, when they were still having these huge outdoor rock concerts in the USA, trying to imitate Woodstock, not 1973. So we were doing Sankirtan, going, you know, from person to person. You know, there's hundreds of thousands of young people coming to these big outdoor concerts. I guess it's like the big day out here in New Zealand, multiplied by a million or something. By this time, the hippie flower power days were, you know, they were showing their natural nature. in which everybody's really just interested in themselves. For some years it had been, you know, love everyone, smile on your brother, and share your drugs with everyone freely, and share your girlfriend with everyone, you know, and just, you know, world peace, harmony. So, but then things are resuming their actual proportion in that people were changing from the so-called softer drugs to the hard drugs. Everything was becoming commercial. There was the original Haight Ashbury spirit of just everything free. Just if you had a house, you would invite anyone to sleep there, you know. And so therefore the term hippie crash pad came about. You know, just everything wide open, you know, just no restrictions, just love one another, you know, let the sun shine, dawning of the age of Aquarius, on and on and on it went. But just like this person was telling me in her 2-month passionate relationship, you know, it's mysteriously the happiness transforms into something else. Of course, we know it's already there, but if you don't understand these things, you're shocked. So the hippie days also change from the blissful, you know, love, flower power, into just hedonism, very selfish, cold hedonism, in which the hard drugs were replacing the soft drugs, and there was violence, and so many things like that. So I remember wandering through the crowd, trying to distribute books as a new devotee, 3 months, approaching people. And then some hippies kind of walked past me, and they could see I was in anxiety. You know, I was a new devotee, trying to approach people with Bhagavad Gita, you know, hundreds of thousands of young people, you know, just, you know, in various stages of intoxication, and just, it was difficult, you know. So I was trying, you know, just going up, you know, showing the Bhagavad Gita. And I remember some hippies took mercy upon me, and they consoled me. They said, "It'll be all right, man. Don't worry. You'll rip somebody off." Yeah. That'd be a consolation. "You'll rip, man. Don't worry." I never forgot that. They just said it so casually, like, "Hey, everyone's ripping everybody. You know, you'll get your chance. Don't worry. Don't be in anxiety." So, this is the nature of material existence. That sooner or later, it comes down to the point, what's in it for me? And people today think that's quite normal. You should be straightforward about that from the very beginning. Don't hide behind any pseudo-religious talk anymore. Just come out with it. What's in it for you? Just like I was reading an article about the new marriage vows. The few people who do agree to get married, they're changing the vows because they feel very uncomfortable with that, you know, till death do us part. So they're changing the lines for their marriage ceremonies. One very popular movie star, she got married and she changed the lines to, "I promise to love you but not obey you." Gee, I see, had that in the marriage vows. Or else they're changing it to, "We'll be together as long as love lasts." Instead of, you know, through sickness and, well, what is it? Yes. Yeah. They're changing all that to just simply, "as long as the love lasts." Or another one was, "as long as our relationship helps the common good." Whatever that means. Because everyone feels a bit weird, you know, saying this till death do us part when, you know, the divorce rate's, you know, over 50%, you know. So this is advancement when you just come right out with your selfish instincts. Tecumseh, he came right out with it. I'm going to kill this brand new baby girl because it's been prophesied that the eighth child of David King will kill me. I've got to kill her first. Devaki pleaded with him. She was daughter of a Kshatriya, daughter of a king, so she knew how to make politics. So first she got on Kamsa's case. She attacked him verbally. You horrid thing, you already killed so many of my children. That was first she lunged forward verbally in that way. And then she retreated to the principle of compromise. Because she knew how to play the art. So she told him, okay, you killed so many of my children, but I know it was all by the laws of nature. It was all karma. It wasn't really you. And then she asked for a gift. So please give me this daughter as a gift. Let her live. I promise she'll marry one of your sons. This is Devaki making politics. Now, the child wasn't hers. Her child, Krishna, had been sent to Vrindavan. And in Krishna's place was the newborn baby of Yashoda Mai. But still, Devaki is acting to save the child of someone else. Actually, Yashoda and Devaki are very close. Nanda Maharaj and Vasudeva are very close. So much so that they're like the same person with different names. Even Yashoda Mai can also be called Devaki. So if you say Devaki Nandan, Krishna the son of Devaki, it actually could also refer to Yashoda Mai. So that's how close they were. So Devaki is doing everything to save someone else's child. And Kamsa couldn't care less. This is a brand new baby girl. No. It's been prophesied that the eighth child of Devaki will kill me. Here is the eighth child. I'm going to kill this child right now, this brand new baby. So he grabbed the little newborn baby by the legs to smash her head against the wall of the prison. But the child leaped into the air. The newborn baby leaped into the air with an eight-handed form, showing, I am Durga Devi, Maya Devi, the material energy personified. You can't kill me. This is Mahamaya appearing because Yogamaya won't show herself to Kamsa, but her illusory department, known as Mahamaya, will. It is Mahamaya that deals with non-devotees. So, Kamsa was immediately shocked. What is this? Because as a materialist, he was a worshiper of the material energy. He understood at least something most people today don't understand, that everything is personal, even the material energy is a person. So he's saying, wow, this is Durga, the material energy personified. I can't believe it. My sister Devaki, an ordinary human being, has given birth to Durga. Glorious is this. And he fell down, paid his obeisances. How horrible I am. I harassed my sister, and she is the mother of Durga, the material energy. How great is this? So, he began to apologize, and Vasudeva and Devaki accepted his apologies. He told them, excuse me for having killed six of your children. These things happen sometimes. Excuse me for having killed six of your newborn babies. You know, it's all the laws of nature. It's all karma. Don't consider me the instrument. You know, understand what the real cause is. It's destiny. And actually, Vasudeva and Devaki forgave him. They did understand that indeed those six babies were getting the reactions to their past life's activities. They also understood that Krishna has been born and he's elsewhere. So, yes, we'll forgive you, And we also know that you're going to die anyway, so. They're Kshatriyas, you know. They know how to be genuinely political. And, you know, yeah, we'll forgive you. Right, it's true. Your philosophy is true. Everything is done according to the laws of nature. You get the reactions to your actions. All that's true. And it's also true that Krishna has been born. He's hidden away safely. He's going to kill you. So, yeah, we'll forgive you. Oh, this is going on at the same time. So, remember when the daughter, Durga, leaped into the air and showed her eight-handed form. She told Kamsa, "You can't kill me. Don't you know that the child you want has been born, is elsewhere. He's been hidden elsewhere." So Kamsa was bewildered. "How is it that I've been lied to? There was a prophecy spoken by a disembodied voice from the sky saying the eighth child of Devaki would kill me and that the eighth child would be a boy. What's going on?" Sound like devotees when something happens to them that, you know, that's not in their astrology. They get completely bewildered. "Wait a minute. The astrologer, I had my chart done. The astrologer told me, you know, that I would have a, you know, I would make a lot of money, or I would marry a beautiful girl. It didn't happen. What's wrong?" So Kamsa was bewildered like that. Are the demigods lying? Are the prophecies lying? The eighth child of David, he was supposed to be a boy, and it's a girl. He was bewildered. Anyway, he still tried to kill the eighth child, what he thought was the eighth child. That didn't stop him from trying to do that. So anyway, now, having seen the glories of Durga with her eight-handed form leaping into the air, he's filled with awe and reverence. All these activities that are going on in this scene are done by Yogamaya and Mahamaya. Yogamaya in relation to Vasudeva and Devaki and Krishna, and Mahamaya in relation to Kamsa and his prison guards. So when you read this Leela, this pastime, you should be aware how these two energies are working simultaneously, arranging all the happenings. So then, after Vasudeva and Devaki forgave Kamsa, he left and went to his quarters. And there his demoniac associates were waiting, his demoniac counselors and advisors. Kamsa told them, "You know, that eighth child that we're after has been born somewhere else. Vasudeva and Devaki, they're very nice. I've forgiven them, they've forgiven me." What did the demoniac advisors say? "Wait a minute. In other words, we don't want peace, we want war. If the eighth child of Devaki has been born elsewhere, this is what must be done, without a doubt. We must kill every newborn child that's been born within the past 10 days throughout the area. And that way we're sure to kill the son of Devaki. We're sure to kill Krishna." They began to explain to Kamsa. "When you have a disease, you have to cure it immediately. You can't delay. So similarly, we have this problem that Krishna has taken birth. We have to take action now. There's no time for morality. Religion doesn't apply in this situation." That was their advice. They did compliment Kamsa. "Normally in battle, you're very merciful to the demigods when you defeat them. They're afraid of you. They're cowardly. You don't attack them, according to proper Vedic military etiquette. But this situation is very drastic. There's no point for religion right now. In this situation, you have to do what you gotta do. Kill every newborn child for miles around. And that way, we're sure to get it back, Krishna. This is no time for religion." Sometimes people say that. "There's no time for religion. It doesn't apply in this situation. You just got to do what you got to do." So that was the advice of the demoniac advisors of Kamsa. And to make him feel confidence, to make Kamsa feel confidence, they told him, Not only are the demigods always afraid of you, but let's just look at the chiefs of the demigods. Vishnu? Why should you be afraid of Vishnu? Where's Vishnu? He's hidden in everyone's hearts. He's trapped in everyone's hearts. As a super soul, he can't get out. So he won't be able to bother you. And where is Shiva? He's in the forest meditating. He won't bother you. And where is Brahma? He's off performing austerities. No one can interfere with you, Kamsa. Do what you gotta do. And then they had an even bigger plan. They had a New World Order conspiracy. They said, the root of the demigods is Vishnu. And the root of Vishnu is Dharma. And the root of Dharma is the Vedas. So if we get to the ultimate root of everything, then we'll solve the problem. Therefore, we should attack Vedic civilization. That's how to get rid of Vishnu. By killing Brahmanas, killing those who are dedicated to Vedic culture, killing cows. We should kill the cows because they give milk, and the milk can be used as ghee for sacrificial yajnas. So we have to kill the cows. We kill the Brahmanas. We destroy truthfulness, austerity, cleanliness, simplicity, any of these religious principles, sub-religious principles, whatever, we destroy it all. That's how to best deal with the situation. Once we get rid of all brahminical qualities, some of them are shocham, shantir, arjivamevacha, Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, the qualities of a brahmana. Control the mind, control the senses, austerity, truthfulness, cleanliness, jnana vijnana, both theoretical and realized knowledge of God. We destroy all those things in civilization. And that way, we destroy the brahmanas, we destroy the demigods, and that way Krishna will be destroyed. Because Krishna is Brahmanya Dev. He's the worshipful lord of the brahmanas. So if we kill all the brahmanas and all brahminical culture, we've actually, in effect, killed Vishnu. So they went about this, actively destroying any kind of dharma, truthfulness, austerity, cleanliness, mercifulness, anything, any good qualities. And that's what you see in civilization today. All these things have been destroyed. Who cares to be truthful? Clean. No one even knows what cleanliness is. Austerity. Practicing austerity for spiritual upliftment. No. Austerity is meant for economic development. You undertake austerities in order to make a lot of money. That's all. Simplicity. No one understands what is simple living. There's no question of learning spiritual knowledge or applying spiritual knowledge. So this is the kind of civilization you have now. And therefore, as a member of that civilization, you have the propensity that you gotta do what you gotta do. Ultimately, religion's got nothing to do with it. And that's the attitude people have when they come here. You just gotta do what you gotta do. Religion, it's a nice idea you have in your mind, but what does it really have with your personal life? Each person should do what he or she thinks is best. That's all. Of course, those who come here, they're fortunate. They're looking for something else. But they've been contaminated by this kind of disease. They can't believe that there could be reactions to their actions. In their hearts, they're actually feeling, I felt good about what I did, so it's okay. They actually believe that in the core of their hearts. Therefore, the whole universe is at peace, because I felt good in my heart about what I did. This is the great tragedy.
No understanding of the system of reactions to actions. This is a very dangerous civilization, in spite of all the so-called conveniences, which actually are a little doubtful, quite doubtful in terms of convenience. The more so-called conveniences are there, the more you have to worry about how to use the conveniences properly. And gradually your simple life is completely destroyed. Remember? You don't remember. You're all too old. Maybe Krishnaloka remembers. Too young. Well, you're all too young. Maybe Krishnaloka remembers. Many years ago, there was the propaganda about every household should have time-saving machines. Now, before your time. This is propaganda in the 50s. Every household should have a mixer. It was all new back then. A mixer and a clothes dryer, clothes washer, dishwasher. Now, that was for very wealthy people then. You should have a telephone. And they were called time-saving machines. You remember that? Yep. It was all propaganda, social propaganda in the 50s. Every middle-class home should have time-saving machines. And the idea was that very soon, everyone would have so much leisure time because of having so many time-saving machines. And you were always told that in the future, the problem of society will be how to handle so much leisure time. This is the propaganda we were told in grade school. Again and again, all the little kids were taught. Very soon, the major problem in society is going to be what to do with so much leisure time. Because of the presence of so many time-saving machines and so many conveniences and new technological breakthroughs, people are going to have so much leisure time. We have to have leisure time experts for the future who will help people deal with their, overload of leisure time. This is what we were all taught. Where is it now? People have so much less time than they ever had before. In spite of all these time-saving machines, in spite of computers, less time than ever before. This is Maya. You don't see the reality that's happening. I remember my family was just a middle-class family, but my mother rarely worked. She was a registered nurse. Every once in a while, she would call into the hospital and say, okay, I'll take a private client for a night or two. She stayed at home and raised her children. Now, for anyone except a very wealthy family, both parents have to work. And even if the family's very wealthy, the wife wants to work because of career. Even if she doesn't have to work, she wants to work to show her prowess. It wasn't like that decades ago. I remember my mother rarely worked. And it was on my whole street. It was ordinary middle-class houses. All the mothers were at home during the day. Now, forget it. No way. Just to make ends meet, both husband and wife have to work. So where's all the time that's saved? This is the nature of material existence. You're promised something, and you always get the opposite. So we have to understand the influence of the material energy scientifically. And we have to understand the influence of the spiritual energy scientifically. Krishna wants you to take part in the same spiritual energy that he thrives in. Sambhavami, Atmamaya, Atmamaya, my own personal energy. He wants you to have that quality of existence. Simply, you change your lifestyle so that you're operating under the influence of Krishna's spiritual energy. Get out from under the influence of the material energy. Then there's a change. Otherwise, there is no change.
as long as you are acting under the influence of the material energy, there must be suffering, because that is what the material energy arranges for you. You can't solve each individual situation as it comes. You've got to make a total solution. Get out from under the influence of the material energy. That is the only lasting solution. All right, any questions? Yes.
How can you tell which energy you're picking up when you're on the material and spiritual energy?
That's why we require guidance in spiritual life. Otherwise, as beginners, we can become confused, thinking something material to be spiritual. But first, you can look and see who's enjoying the results of the activity. That's an easy way to judge. All activities are done to get a result. So you look and see who's the enjoyer of the results of what I'm doing. Then you'll be able to understand what energy you're operating under. Now, of course, there are finer and finer points. But at least, at first, look at the results and who the enjoyer is. Yes?
I'm looking at the relationship between free will and destiny. For example, the last name of Devaki, they know that prophecy, and still they became emotionally involved in the action, even though it's predestined.
What is predestined?
Yeah, Krishna will kill.
Yeah, but Krishna's Leela is so absorbing that even if you know the outcome, still you get caught up in it. That's how good Krishna is at doing his thing. Even though you know in advance, Vasudeva and Devaki knew in advance, still they couldn't resist getting caught up. You see, I've told you this before, you've never seen a movie that good in which even though you know what's going to happen at the end, because you've seen it so many times, still you get caught up in it. But Krishna can do that. His Leela, his pastimes, are so attractive that even Vasudeva and Devaki knew, still they couldn't help but get caught up in it. And they actually felt fear for Krishna. We've got to protect Krishna. He's God, he can't be killed, but we have to protect him because he's our son. They're caught up in that emotional status. Whereas Yashoda Mai and Nanda Maharaj, they never thought Krishna's God. Just like the cowherd boys in Vrindavan. This is a summer pastime. Apparently, in Krishna's spiritual abode, the sun can become very hot, but it's not a material experience of distress. It's just a different way of experiencing the spiritual energy. And everything is simply related to Krishna's pleasure. So the cowherd boys and the calves are wandering in the Vrindavan forest. Balaram has stayed at home because it's his birthday. Balaram's birthday is before Krishna's birthday. So it's summertime. And the calves and the cowherd boys are feeling the intense heat. So they go ahead, leaving Krishna behind. They want to get to the Jamuna River to drink the cooling waters. And as they kneel down at the bank of the river and drink, they fall down dead. Because that part of the Jamuna River has been poisoned by the Kaliya serpent. Now, how is it they fell down dead? It was by Krishna's arrangement. Daiva, his spiritual energy, his Daivi Shakti. He wanted his friends to experience dying and coming back to life in a place where there's no birth and death. There's no birth and death in Vrindavan. But Krishna wanted them to have the fun of feeling like they died, and then he would revive them. This is how good it is in Vrindavan. There's no death. But Krishna says, okay, don't you want to, let's play. You want to feel like it, you want to feel like you died? So Krishna did that. They drank the water of the Jamuna River, which was poison, and the cowherd boys and their calves fell down on the bank unconscious, dead. And then Krishna felt compassion upon them. This is why it's called lila, or pastime. There's nothing forced. Krishna created the situation, and now he's feeling compassion. Oh, my friends have died. What to do? So then with his glance of nectar, he revived them just by looking at them with his glance. And so the cowherd boys and the calves, they jumped up. They started looking at each other, speaking with their eyes. What happened to us? I think we died. But what brought us back to life? Was it some medicinal herb? Was it some mantra? With their eyes, you know, they were speaking like that, inquiring of each other. What happened? And then one cowherd boy spoke up. I know what happened. Krishna, by his glance, he brought us back to life, even though we had died. And they all began to look at each other. Wow. We died. That's really cool. And the one cowherd boy, he continued to explain. Don't you remember what Gargacharya said? At the Namakarana ceremony, the name-giving ceremony of Krishna and Balaram, he said, this child is favored by Narayan, and so this child will save us from all difficulties. That's the solution. This is Krishna special by the power of Narayan. In fact, because Nanda Maharaj is such a diligent worshiper of Narayan, therefore, his child Krishna, our friend, has special mercy. Because his father worships the deity of Narayan. That was their conclusion. So you might wonder, why is there such a thing as intense heat in Vrindavan, Krishna's private abode? But no. It's just all for Krishna's pleasure. These things are props for enjoying of pleasurable pastimes. So even the so-called distress is pleasurable. It's just a different way of experiencing relationships with Krishna. There's no sukha or dukkha, no happiness or distress in the spiritual world. Even what looks like pain and even what looks like distress is simply a pure spiritual experience, just a different variety of tasting love of Krishna. So when you first come to Krishna consciousness, you can taste that. You just don't know what you're tasting. You have to become conscious of it to safeguard the great jewel you have and to make it grow. So that is the process of bhakti yoga. Anything else? Yes.
Could you describe how you gave the teacher to anchor
all the by thinking about it. And considering it again and again deep in the core of your heart. You know how to do that, yes? What was it like when you wanted to marry? Did you consider it back and forth? Could this be the one? Right? Right? Yes, it was in the core of your heart, wasn't it? Is this Mr. Wright? Right? Didn't he? Backwards and forwards, up and down, all around. Of course. It became such a consuming reality, right? As only ladies can understand. Like, this is it. Unless this happens, the universe comes to an end. Right? Right? The whole universe has come to a standstill to wait for this result. Now, that shows you the potency you have for considering things. Now, why can't you consider this information from Srimad Bhagavatam in such a way. You can't say you don't know how to intensely consider something. You do. But the normal tendency is to think, yes, that intense consideration is for things that are very dear to you and necessary for you. But, you know, spiritual knowledge, yeah, it's interesting, but, you know, it's not like a gut issue. That's the mistake. Just like a drowning person wants air, that's how much you have to want to understand Srimad Bhagavatam. Yes? Prolong? What do you mean, prolong? There's a time and place for everything. Krishna does everything perfectly. He wanted to stay in Vrindavan and have these spontaneous pastimes with Nanda Maharaj and Yashoda, in which they didn't understand he's God. First he wanted to do that, and then he would go to Mathura when he was 11 and take care of Kamsa. So his first priority was to leave Mathura and go to Vrindavan to enjoy the sweetest pastimes. That's more important than killing Kamsa. To enjoy with the cowherd boys, with the cowherd girls, with his parents, that's more important than killing Kamsa. Actually, Krishna, the original personality of Godhead, doesn't kill Kamsa. That's done by an expansion of Krishna. Yes?
You describe about the heavy karma to be born in both Korea. And is it...
Oh, I forgot you're from Korea.
So is it part of the bad karma to not be able to...
You don't know what the future is going to be. I used to think that about people who lived in communist countries. You don't know. There's no injustice in the cosmic manifestation. If people want to avoid Krishna so intensely, Krishna will create a situation through material nature where they can never find out what is Krishna. Some spirit souls are like that. Put me in a place where I can never hear Hare Krishna. All right, take birth in North Korea. But then again, Lord Chaitanya is so merciful. He's more merciful than Krishna. So things change. If you want to be a first-class demoniac person, the super soul in the heart will help you. Okay? You want to forget all about me? I'll help you forget me. You can't forget Krishna without his help. Similarly, you can't forget your material desires without Krishna's help. For the devotee, Krishna helps you to forget your material desires. For the materialistic person, Krishna helps them to forget him. In either case, you need Krishna's help. I think we'll stop now. We'll have Prabhupada's Guru Puja. Thank you very much.